It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Des Moines Register, Mediacom, Iowa poll conducted earlier this month, October 3rd through the 6th, published, though, this week, found that the majority of Iowans felt that the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Pipeline was not given enough study in terms of its possible benefits and consequences. Joining me to discuss the results of the poll and the latest developments with what's also called the Bakken Oil Pipeline, Bill Petrowski, state governmental reporter at the Des Moines Register. Hi again, Bill.
Hi, nice to talk with you, Ben.
So tell us a little bit more about these poll numbers and what they show.
Well, what's interesting here is that it kind of, I think as time has gone on, Iowans have become a little bit more uncomfortable with this pipeline. It was originally announced in June 2014. We polled on this pipeline originally in February 2015. And what we found was that 57% of Iowans at that time favored the pipeline, 32% were opposed. However, 74% were opposed to using eminent domain to build pipelines or transmission lines. Fast forward to February 2016, and that 57% support had dropped to 47% support. And, you know, this project was subsequently approved in March by the Iowa Utilities Board by a 3-0 vote, and then they voted 2-1 to in June to allow construction to proceed. And just my take from talking with people out there in the communities where this pipeline is going in is, as the pipeline as the construction crews have arrived, as they mowed down, you know, hundreds of acres of corn and soybeans, a lot of people look out there and they say, oh my gosh, what's, you know, this is a little bit more than we had expected. And of course, some farmers, it's going through their fields and they really hadn't wanted it done. And so in those counties, boards, county compensation boards have been created which have forced them to accept the pipeline through their farm.
Mm-hmm. And perhaps the opposition to the pipeline, those people, those forces have become better organized over time and raised more awareness.
Oh, absolutely. This pipeline had been opposed all along by groups like Iowa CCI. There's a group called the Bakken Resistance Coalition. Ed Fallon, former state legislator, he is now head of a group called Bold Iowa. He had walked across the state holding meetings in regards to this pipeline and tried to spur opposition. But one of the things that also happened was this thing was built, you're probably aware that a lot of attention has been given nationally to the opposition of this in North Dakota by Indian tribes and Indians, and environmentalists from all over the country have gathered there. And I think the whole thing is just, the opposition has just kind of picked up steam is what's happened.
Bill, back to the poll. Break it down in terms of specific categories here. Men, women, is it a partisan divide there you see in the numbers?
Exactly. Women more than men are likely to say that the pipeline has not received enough study. Democrats, by far overwhelmingly, 70% of Democrats said that not enough study was given, while a plurality of Republicans, 44%, said that it has received enough study. Then just looking at it through the state's four congressional districts, which are broken into pretty much quadrants, people in Iowa, southeast Iowa, are most likely to say the pipeline was not studied enough, and that's 58%. It also showed that city dwellers believe more study is needed, 57% to 25%, while rural residents are evenly split at 41% on each side.
Mm-hmm. That matches up, though, also with party affiliation when we talk about urban versus rural. What do you see here? The Iowa Utilities Board, as you said, approved the section, the 3-0 vote. These were all appointees by Governor Branstad. Has this had any impact on Governor Branstad's approval ratings?
Well, I don't know if it's had any. I don't know if it's directly related to Governor Branstad's approval ratings, but his current approval rating is 48%. And I asked him about this study, you know, the board's actions on Monday. He had his weekly press conference. He said, my gosh, he said, you know, this pipeline has received more scrutiny than any project that he can remember in his six terms in office. There were informational meetings held in each of the 18 counties in Iowa that this pipeline is going through. There was 12 days of public hearing. There were thousands and thousands of public comments, and there were literally weeks of deliberations. And in fact, this pipeline was approved months earlier in North Dakota, South Dakota, and Illinois by state regulators there. And the industry, in fact, people in support of this, I should say business and labor people, they really accused the Iowa Utility Board of dragging its feet. And the people from the Iowa Utilities Board said, no, we are going to do due diligence on this as long as it takes for us to do it. We're going to give it proper scrutiny. So I'm sure that they feel that they have given it plenty of study. On the other hand, you and I had talked about this before, Ben, and as you're aware, months and months before this pipeline was even considered for approval, the company, Dakota Access, or at least its suppliers, they were bringing this pipeline into the state, and this pipe was stacked up all over the state, which made a lot of people feel like, hey, this was a done deal ahead of time, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Winter, not far off. Feel the crisp air, will this be done by the time winter arrives?
I think that's where things are headed. As you're probably aware, they are going like heck working on this. I talked the other day with Bill Gerhard, the head of the Iowa Building Construction Trades Council, and he told me the people that he talks to out there who are out there working in the field, they are out there working 7 days a week, up to 12 hours a day. They are working very, very hard. What we see is that there was a construction report filed Wednesday with the Iowa Utilities Board by Dakota Access, and it essentially showed that throughout the state of Iowa, 58% of the pipeline has been already lowered into the ground and backfilled, so it's essentially there, and they are working very, very hard. Essentially, the pipeline is pretty much 100% done in six counties: Keokuk, Polk, Story, O'Brien, Sioux, and Lyon. And there's a lot of work underway in all of the other counties. I think statewide, something like 78% of the pipe has been welded. So the company is pretty optimistic that they are going to get this pipeline finished in Iowa before real cold weather, heavy snow arrives. But as you're aware, we just mentioned the situation in North Dakota, where the there's a strong opposition. So we'll have to see we'll have to see what happens.
Well, does this leave the lawsuit people out in the cold, so to speak?
Well, that is another factor, as you point out. Yes, there is a trial it's been consolidated among people who are opposed to it, but the Sierra Club of Iowa is challenging the decision by the Iowa Utilities Board to approve this, and then there's a group of landowners who are challenging the constitutionality of the state's eminent domain law. Arguments on that will be held in December in Polk County District Court, and whatever verdict that is, that's going to end up being appealed to the Iowa Supreme Court. So then I guess the obvious question is, gosh, what would happen if the Iowa Supreme Court ruled in favor of the opponents? Would the pipeline be dismantled? I honestly don't know, and I don't think anybody really knows what would happen. I think people assume some type of accommodation would be made. But there's still a lot of things to be played out here. But I don't know that anybody expected as much opposition here in Iowa. You know, there had been some opposition all along, but it's really kind of mushroomed. There's been more than 150 people. There's been more than 150 arrests made in Iowa, at any rate, since late August by protesters trying to disrupt construction just in Iowa. And I know tomorrow up in Lorville in west central Iowa that there's going to be another big protest up there, and some people will likely be trying to stand in farmers' fields to try to stop the construction. So there could be more arrests this weekend.
On to another bit of reporting this week from you, Bill. You reported on some new poll numbers in the U.S. Senate race here in Iowa. Republican Charles Grassley, six-term incumbent, facing Democrat Patty Judge, and also others in the other parties. Any sign of a down ballot effect of his Grassley's continued support for Donald Trump?
Well, we've talked with legislators about this kind of thing, and I think what they will tell you, well, there's a couple things here. Having been around politics for about 40 years, I absolutely think that there could be an impact. But if you talk with people here in Iowa, they will also tell you, gosh, we know our politicians so well that that kind of reduces the down ballot effect. I know I've talked with Senate Majority Leader Mike Ronsdell repeatedly about this issue, and he will tell you that they view their state Senate, Iowa House races as local races involving one local person against another local person, and that's mostly how it's been decided. But what I always go back to is I know that I've been through a number of these quote-unquote wave elections, and there can be a ripple effect all the way down the ballot to dog catcher. I mean, that is really the reality, that it can have some impact. And if you have very, very close races, which we do have sometimes here in Iowa, state Senate races, state House races decided by 100 or less votes, that kind of thing can make a difference. So we'll see.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. People will perhaps be doing some split ticket voting.
Oh, absolutely.
We'll see. Bill Petrosky, state governmental reporter at the Des Moines Register. Always good to talk with you, Bill. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, now after a week of news that perhaps left you feeling low, the uplifting story of a simple act of kindness here in Iowa. During a race last week in the Knoll Ridge Park Cross Country Race Course, that's in Cedar Rapids, a surprising show of friendship between two cross country members from different teams, and they crossed the finish line together. After Washington High School's Adam Todd, a high school student with epilepsy and autism, became distracted during the race, Iowa City High's Evan Hansen lent a hand to help get him back on the track. And he joins us now. Evan Hansen, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Tell us what happened. So this is a cross-country race, a lot of competitors out there. How far along were you in this race?
About halfway. We were about a mile and a half.
Mm-hmm. So the total race is how long?
3 miles.
So in this 3 mile race, you're a mile and a half into it, about halfway. When did you notice something wasn't quite normal?
Adam had veered off the course, looking at an ambulance. I just turned around, did help him.
Mm-hmm. So you knew about his disability, and you knew immediately what was going on.
I didn't know what specific disability he had, but I knew he had a disability.
Mm-hmm. And so he was watching an ambulance. He was distracted by that.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So you went over to him, and then what happened?
I turned around and just said, come on, Adam, let's go. Let's go, Adam. Basically just motivation, and then we ran together for the rest of the race, mile and a half.
So it wasn't that he was tired. He was just distracted.
Distracted, yes.
Mm-hmm. Was there any moment there when you thought, well, maybe I should just continue on and try to get the best time I can in this cross-country race?
Well, no, not really. I already knew I was having a bad race. I've been injured. It was my first race of the season, so I just thought it would be – I wasn't going to PR anyways, so I knew that. And I thought it was better to help Adam than to even try to PR.
Right. And nevertheless, even though you weren't having the best race, a real nice act of kindness. Now, when you got to the finish line, tell us about the scene there.
There was, I think, everyone that was still at Knoll Ridge was at the finish and just cheering me and Adam on. And when we finished, there was I think it was very loud. I don't know, though. I kind of tuned out. Mm-hmm. And his dad came up to me and said some very, very nice things. I think he was very happy.
His Adam's father, can you remember what he said?
He said to me, "Wow, that was amazing, son." And then he said stuff about, I can't remember exactly, but at the end he said, like, good things are going to happen to you in the future.
I bet that's a good prediction. Well, Evan Hansen, thank you for sharing this very nice story with us. And keep up the running. I hope your injuries improve so that you can have a better race. But I think in most people's minds, you won this one.
Thank you.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. In November, the Iowa African American Hall of Fame will induct four new members. The Hall of Fame was founded back in 1995 to recognize the outstanding achievements of African Americans who have enhanced the quality of life for all Iowans. Here to tell us a little bit about this year's inductees, Kenyatta Schamberger is director of Multicultural Student Affairs at Iowa State University in our Ames studio. Kenyatta, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. Thank you. It's good to be here.
We have about 5 minutes. Let's talk about these inductees. Dr. Keisho Scott of Grinnell, Betty Andrews of Des Moines, Henry Harper of Iowa City, and posthumously James B. Morris, Jr. of Des Moines. Tell us a little bit about each of them.
So, thank you. Dr. Scott, we'll learn, is the first African-American woman to receive tenure at Grinnell College, and she currently serves as the Associate Professor of American Studies and Sociology. She's written frequently and spoken on race relations, diversity, inclusion, women's issues, and cultural competency. And so she has done some great work, and that the Hall of Fame board wanted to recognize her.
Kenyatta, she's been on this program several times, and we are always appreciative of her insights, pointing out and unlearning racism, perhaps pointing out isms of all kinds and where we might not even see them, right?
Exactly. And so because of the work that she has done throughout the state specifically, but then even on the national stage, is why the committee certainly wanted to recognize her for her efforts.
Mm-hmm. Betty Andrews has also been on this program of Des Moines. Tell us a little bit about her.
Okay. And so many of you may know Betty Andrews. She has done some great work with I'll Make Me a World in Iowa, that the annual celebration of African-American heritage that happens each year. She is also very involved with the Iowa-Nebraska State Conference of the NAACP, where she currently serves as president. And in her work there, she has led efforts to reform the criminal justice system and bringing equity and equality into the Iowa courts. And so another strong advocate for justice and public service who will be recognized in just a few weeks at the dinner.
Mm-hmm. Henry Harper is from Iowa City. He's worked with youth and families.
Yeah, exactly. Henry has worked very closely, as you said, with youth and families, and specifically enabling challenged youth to meet what many may believe are insurmountable goals in their schoolwork and community organizing. And so he has worked to help bring communities together to support interagency cooperation between law enforcement, community residents, and students. Ultimately helping many of these young men and women to transition to college. So moving from where some may think that they may not be success stories, but being able to take advantage of some of the educational resources and ultimately change the narrative.
Mm-hmm. And finally, the fourth, a posthumous recognition in the African American Hall of Fame here in Iowa, James B. Morris.
So James B. Morris, Jr., was the first black assistant Polk County attorney, and so had a distinguished career as a trial attorney. He was also a war veteran serving in World War II in the South Pacific, where he earned the Bronze Star and was one of the first African American officers to lead white troops into combat. And so, as an attorney, he actually had the opportunity to serve and practice law with his father in Des Moines for many years, and they had some great success in the legal profession. And his father, ironically, is also a member of the Hall of Fame. And James's son is also an inductee. So it has come full circle.
Wow.
In that with the Morris family, it's a family affair. So.
Right, right. And we have to remember, I'm thinking, 60 or 70 Hall of Famers at this point since this 1995 founding of the Iowa African American Hall of Fame. Is that in the ballpark?
Correct. It's 65. And then this year there will be four new inductees.
Mm-hmm. So can anybody visit the Hall of Fame? Where is it located? You know?
Their seat is at the Black Cultural Center, which is on the campus of Iowa State University on Welch Avenue. And there are a few artifacts from the Hall of Fame, but one of the major goals of the board is to have a permanent home for the Hall of Fame, where by the achievements of the inductees can be housed and displayed in a clearer place where the public can come and visit. So.
Mm-hmm. Kenyatta, we have just less than a minute left. Tell us why this Hall of Fame is important. We've had an African-American president for nearly 8 years now, the first one the United States has ever had, but also years of racial tension, questions about police treatment of black Americans, for instance.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think the Hall of Fame, even with the narrative of negativity that has happened in our country with race relations, et cetera, I think the Hall of Fame highlights the positive work, attributes, advocacy that each of the inductees have brought, not only on a nationwide scale, but in Des Moines, in the state of Iowa. And so I think it gives many local people an opportunity to look up to some local heroes. So.
Kenyatta Schamberger, thank you very much for coming into our studio, Director of Multicultural Student Affairs at Iowa State University. We appreciate it, Kenyatta.
Thank you. It's glad to be here.
Okay, coming up in just a moment, we'll find out how Iowa agriculture connects to food insecurity the world over and why Bob Dylan's work is set apart. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's a NewsBuzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This Sunday is World Food Day. It's a day dedicated to action against hunger, and it falls just after a week of food security-focused seminars and lectures at the World Food Prize in Des Moines. Patricia Haslack was the United States Ambassador to Ethiopia from 2013 to just last month, and is now the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Economic and Business Affairs. Claire Roth spoke with her yesterday.
Good afternoon, Ambassador Haslack.
Good afternoon. It's a real pleasure for me to be here.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. So tell us a little bit about what you've been focusing on at this year's World Food Prize.
Well, what we've been focusing on is addressing, of course, the issues of hunger. And that's really been the theme and a constant theme, hunger, food security, but also how we use technology and how do we persuade people the benefits of technology. And I would just like to maybe start off with a wonderful quote by Julie Borlaug, who is the granddaughter, of course, of the famous Dr. Borlaug, where she said that you can't be anti-hunger and anti-technology at the same time. And that I really think that sort of captures the theme. There's an official theme, but at least the theme that I'm most interested while I'm here at the World Food Prize.
Interesting. How have you seen technology and food security intersect in your work in Ethiopia and otherwise?
Actually, I haven't seen it interact much, and in fact, that's why I'm here. I think the focus actually needs to be on both fortifying food for nutritional reasons. Ethiopia has extremely high rates of children both stunting and wasting. But we've just been through in Ethiopia, just faced the worst drought in 50 years, and that's an El Nino impact on Ethiopia. It's unlike a number of the other droughts that the other food shortages that we're seeing in the world, which are conflict. But this one was El Nino, and Ethiopia faces this every 6 years, and really allowing technology, and I'll just give one good example, would be if Ethiopia, we could get some good sorghum in there that could withstand drought, and that could also be we could nutritionally fortify for children. It would make such a significant difference for the pastoralists, the ones that we've been feeding 6 months out of the year. We provide assistance with other donors to their public food distribution system. And then, of course, this year, the U.S. government through USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, we provided close to $800 million worth of food assistance, mainly food grains, but also corn soya blend, an important product that is produced here in Iowa that really, really helps with children and nutrition.
Mm. You started your career in government in the USDA. How have you seen the perspective of the federal government evolve in regards to food production and food security over the years?
Well, food security now is a national security interest subject, and President Obama, of course, has made this one of his key focus, has been on food security, because if you're hungry, it causes all sorts of problems, but it also causes conflict when countries are fighting over food or fighting over water or fighting over land. Of course, the effects of climate change, it all comes together under food security, and this has been a major focus of the current administration. When I came into government in the 1980s, in fact, I worked on the Ethiopian drought in the mid-1980s, and seeing that firsthand, or at least being involved in the humanitarian response to that. And then going back in 2010 when I was our deputy coordinator for the Feed the Future initiative, and to see the difference that our assistance through the Feed the Future initiative had made, that Ethiopia was really able to deal with this drought. And what I mean by that is that we really didn't see large-scale famine like we saw in the 1980s. So big, big difference. And that's not just due to the United States. It's due to the other the donor community. But it's also due to the government of Ethiopia, which really has made a commitment to addressing poverty and to addressing food issues and to becoming hopefully a middle-income country by 2025.
You know, I think that's such an interesting point, because when we think about food and agriculture issues in this country, we have the luxury of food production at least being bountiful. So help us understand the perspective of someone who lives somewhere where getting enough food every day is a real struggle.
Well, I'd like to quote another one of the speakers who spoke at one of the Borlaug events, Dr. Dingra from Washington State University. He said it's easy to stand against technology with a full belly and 2020 vision. And I think we tend not to really appreciate how lucky we are when it comes to food and food choices. And for me, to see children that are on intravenous feeding because they are starving to death is I think, really, really changes your perspective. And to see children that are being revived due to food like corn soya blend or plumpy nut, which is made out of peanuts, or other food that we're trying to provide these children. But I think the problem is if you don't get these children in the first 1,000 days, the impact on their growth, on their mental capacity is severely restricted. So really, I think when you see this and you hear all of this discussion about natural foods and don't use technology, it's really upsetting, because if you were to ask an Ethiopian pastoralist how they felt about this, they would say, please get us food, help us be able to grow and produce food. You know, they don't want to be dependent on food assistance. They want to be able to grow food, but they have so many challenges that relate to weather relate to issues like land size, relate to shortages of water. And, you know, to really, really see that firsthand, and Ethiopia is not the first place I've seen this. I also saw it in Afghanistan, and I've seen it in other countries as well. So I think we need to use technology for the benefit of mankind, and I think there's no greater need than in the area of food and nutrition.
Mm. Smack dab in the middle of the breadbasket as we are in Iowa, it's hard to feel connected to those hungry people that you mentioned that are half a world away. So how do U.S. and Iowan farmers fit into this picture of global food security?
Well, Iowan farmers are critical. U.S. farmers are critical. We are the world's biggest donor to the World Food Program. We are also not just the biggest donor. We are also working through our land-grant universities like Iowa State and others to try to build up the capacity in many of these countries. And our setting up these land-grant universities many, many years ago has really yielded benefits. So it's through education. It's through capacity building. It's through symposiums like the Borlaug World Food Prize Symposium, where we can bring together people like Dr. Gabisa from Ethiopia, who's worked on just what I was saying, a sorghum. I think Iowa farmers and Iowa citizens should be very, very proud of what they've done to help not only just feed the world, but also spread the technology and the know-how.
Speaking of those exports you mentioned, TPP has been a huge issue in this mm-hmm. year's election.
Mm-hmm.
How would it impact the agricultural exports from states like Iowa? Can you give us the concept of before and after?
It will only go up. It's positive. It is a platinum trade agreement. I've worked on trade agreements my whole life. I'm a little bit amazed that folks are anti-trade. I just don't understand. I actually do have some statistics. But I'm not going to read them all off to you. But when you think that U.S. Jobs supported just by goods exported from Iowa in 2015, it was over 100,000. Goods exported from Iowa, $13.2 billion. And 83% of those were from small and medium-sized enterprises. And we estimate that if TPP goes through, that the benefits will just be exponential in a place like Iowa. And I would also like to point out, if we don't pass it, we will cede the ground to others. And I think that will ultimately hurt our economy and potentially hurt our farming communities.
Another thing you mentioned in that discussion of the connections between us and these other areas of the world is the concept of education, of techniques. And something that strikes me is the parallels that we see in food challenges no matter where you are in the world. You know, crop yield is going to be an issue. Disease is going to be an issue. Drought's going to be an issue. You mentioned Ethiopia facing the worst drought in 50 years.
50 years, yes.
Yeah. So what do you think Midwestern agriculture and Sub-Saharan African and agriculture can learn from one another?
Well, I think already many of the companies that produce seed varieties and things like that get some of the, you know, they're working with farmers in those communities. So testing out, you know, can that particular crop withstand a drought? Why does this one, challenges with this one or that one? It's all through the scientific method. It's through the universities. It's through exchanges, for example, with Iowa State, with universities on the continent of Africa. It's through students who come to Africa to study, and from students from Africa who come to the United States to study. It's a two-way street. We benefit from this. There is a crop in Ethiopia called teff, which if any of you have had Ethiopian food, the famous bread called injera, well, that is a non-gluten, high iron grain. And here's a grain that, and by the way, the Ethiopians attribute that to all their winnings at the Olympics. They think it makes them great runners, and I would have to agree. But here's an example of a food that would yield benefits to everyone, not just Ethiopians.
You mentioned Save the Children. It's concerned with the healthcare outcomes for mothers and children in Ethiopia. How do you see food security and healthcare intersecting?
Well, it's interesting because when I started working on Feed the Future, we had Secretary Clinton was at the Secretary of State, and she was really interested in this issue, children and children in nutrition. And she sponsored an event with the Prime Minister from Ireland. And, you know, Ireland has a special role in famine, having so many of us, including even my ancestors, having come over during the Great Famine in Ireland. So a real focus on trying to address issues of nutrition. And she sponsored an event called 1,000 Days with the Prime Minister from Ireland. And, you know, it's so wonderful that we were just at this function, and the author, Dr. Thoreau, has just published a book called The First 1,000 Days. And again, it emphasizes the importance of nutrition, the importance of getting the nutrients into children. So as the president of the African Development Bank just said, so that gray matter resource is fully developed. Because if a child doesn't get nutrients in the first 1,000 days, it's been proven that their ability to learn, their ability to grow up and be prosperous and contribute to society is less. And so I think we really need to focus on, we also need to, of course, focus on the mother. The nutrition of the mother is critically important as well.
Ambassador Haslach, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Patricia Haslach was the United States Ambassador to Ethiopia from 2013 to just last month, and she's now the Principal Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Economic and Business Affairs.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Finally today, a historic first for that prestigious prize created by Swedish inventor Alfred Nobel in 1895. This week, the Nobel Committee announced that Bob Dylan is the winner of this year's Nobel Prize in Literature. David Gaines is with us, author of In Dylan Town, A Fan's Life, published by the University of Iowa Press last year. In it, he writes about the music, words, story, and fans of the songwriting legend who was born Robert Allen Zimmerman in Duluth, Minnesota. David Gaines, welcome to the program.
I'm happy to be with you guys. It's
hey.
Very exciting. It's just a great day for literature and for Dylan fans and my family and friends.
Mm-hmm. So give us a little more of your reaction. You've just come out with this book, In Dylan Town, and coincidentally, he has the Nobel Prize. So you've enjoyed some attention yourself, I assume.
Good assumption. I'm thinking about changing the title to In Dylan World, if we could do a second edition. But it has been really terrific. I've received all kinds of email from Jeff Rosen and Dylan's manager, former students of mine, so many people I've met along the Dylan Trail, because the ripples are many and powerful. But when my wife yesterday morning at 6:17 a.m., as I was shaving, she said, "Guess what?" And it was that tone of voice that I thought either something terrific had happened for one of our children or a presidential candidate had dropped out of the race. And she said, "Bob just won." And seriously, for about 2 hours afterwards, I was just yo-yoing between goosebumps and tears, and just so many sweet notes from people. And, you know, we're at a time in the world, I think, where it'd be good to have some good news. And I think it's great news. I'm very excited.
The first time a musician has won the Nobel Prize for Literature. So what do you think this does to the idea of literature going in this direction? What is perhaps the message the Nobel Committee is sending, you think?
Well, I love it. I think it's a bigger tent. I really do. I don't want to say I called my shot, but on page 3 of my book, I said the odds on Dylan keep going down. He's on the short list with Philip Roth and Don DeLillo and lots of other people. And part of the argument of my book and part of the through line in my career in life is that we're all at the table of joy. And the table of joy should be about more than novels and plays and poetry. It should also be about film and music and all other kinds of beautiful works that people do with language and imagination. So I think it's very exciting.
Mm-hmm. I wonder what Dylan lyrics or songs came to mind when you heard about the news.
Oh, wow. Well, Tambourine Man jumped into my head because I just thought there's that stanza in Tambourine Man, I think, which was my gateway to Dylan, that I think take me disappearing through the smoke rings of my mind. I thought that's in there. I thought Desolation Row, which Allen Ginsberg said should have been the national anthem. I thought about Tangled Up in Blue and Keep on Keeping On. I often begin my American literature class with Paul Simon's America and with Dylan's Talking World War III Blues, in which he says about America, good luck. So I thought about humor, and I thought about love songs, and I thought about images, and it just a lot of stuff washed over me.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Paul Simon. Do you think this opens the door for other songwriters in the future? Most certainly, I guess.
Well, I would think in theory it does. I've been asked this by a couple of people, and I really don't feel, as much as I love Paul Simon's work and Joni Mitchell's and Van Morrison's and Leonard Cohen's, I don't think they're quite on the same level as Dylan. I think Dylan is really more a peer, if you will, a kindred spirit to Garcia Marquez and to Toni Morrison and to Faulkner, people who really have created large worlds. And I think the other difference with Dylan and other songwriters is I think it's very significant that he's quoted and paraphrased all over the place. Chicago in 1968 at the Democratic Convention in the streets, Tiananmen Square, in more legal decisions in the last 20 years, Dylan has been quoted more frequently than any writer in any genre. So I think I love those songwriters and those performers that I mentioned and others, but I think Dylan's, if you will, literariness, his just the way he's seeped into the culture and what he's given us and people around the world. I mean, it is a world wide award, and you look at all the news stories around the world. It's very. I think he's in a world of his own with a few other giants.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps you already somewhat answered this question, but Bob Dylan's music first entered the American psyche in the 1960s, and you talked about Tiananmen Square in 1968 and so forth. How relevant are his themes for today, 2016, in our current tumult, perhaps?
Well, the times they are a-changing, cliche that is still more relevant than ever, I think. I think his you got to serve somebody. I mean, the whole born again Christian phase, the late 70s, a lot of those songs in a uncanny way resonate again. But I also think he's talking about really timeless things as well. I mean, yes, the political import and the political uses of his language and songs, it's there. But I think he's writing about, and has always written about, so many different things. But he's also talking about timelessness.
All right, we'll leave it there. Thanks very much. And we'll go out with a little Blowing in the Wind, since you named that tune. Bob Dylan winning the Nobel Prize in Literature, first musician to ever capture that prize, and first American writer to do so since 1993. Been speaking with David Gaines, author of In Dylan Town, A Fan's Life, published by University of Iowa Press last year. David is professor of English at Southwestern University in Georgetown, Texas. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, David.
Thank you. Pleasure speaking with you guys. And in the words of the Nobel Prize winner, keep on keeping on.
All right, David.
How many times must a man look up before he really sees the sky? must to one cursing hand before he can hear people cry. How many deaths will it take till he knows that too many people have died? The answer, my friend, is blowing in the wind. The answer is blowing in the wind.
We're going to blow out of this program into the weekend. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Keep on keeping on into the weekend. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.